Welcome to Believe is Question Worthy. Nice to have you here today. In this episode, we want to talk about the life of Jesus, especially his resurrection. And we have invited Mike Ikona. We are really honored that you're here. You are a real expert in this field, especially on the resurrection of Jesus. And we're happy that you join us today. We want to get you to know a little, and I'll hand over to Hannah for that.
Yes, thank you very much. Mike, it is a great honor to have you here today. You are internationally recognized as one of the leading experts on the historical resurrection of Jesus. You have a PhD in New Testament studies from the University of Pretoria and an MA, a master's degree in religious studies from Liberty University, which makes you a strong academic for the foundation in ancient historiography, philosophy, and textual criticism. You are a professor of New Testament at Houston Christian University and the president of Jesus Risen Jesus Ministry. In your research, you focus on the historical resurrection of Jesus, the historical reliability of the Gospels, and ancient biographical writings and its relevance for the Gospel interpretation. Your major works were several books. I have some listed here. The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach from 2010. And Why Are There Differences in the Gospel from 2016. You also co-authored the book The Case for the Resurrection of Jesus with Gary Habermas, which is widely used as an introduction to the minimal facts approach. Yes, and you regularly debate with several partners, which are often prominent skeptics, for example, Bart Ehrman. You're a sought-after speaker, and you're respected also beyond evangelical circles for your methodological and your academic integrity. And we are very honored to have you here today. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Hannah, for having me.
Yeah, let's dive right in. Mike, there are many big stories in the Bible. Why do you think the resurrection of Jesus is the key issue? And isn't this, at the end of the day, mainly a question of faith?
Well, in answer to the question, why is it a key issue? Jesus made it such. So Jesus made some very radical claims while on earth. He claimed to be God's uniquely divine son. He claimed to have authority to forgive sins. He claimed to be that one's eternal destiny would be decided by him. So when you make those kinds of claims, your critics are going to ask for some evidence. And he said that he would provide one, his resurrection from the dead. So if Jesus did not rise from the dead, he's a false prophet. He's a fraud whom no rational person should follow. But if he did rise from the dead, well, then it would seem that he did so in confirmation of his claims. And that gives us something very seriously on which to ponder. Now, the second part of your question, is it just a matter of faith? I'd say no. Jesus, when he gave us that test, it wasn't a matter of, well, just believe that I rise from the dead. You know, you have various tests within different religions. So you have Mormons, and Mormons say, if you want to know if Mormonism is true, just read the Book of Mormon and pray and ask God to tell you if it's true, and he will. And yes, many have prayed and are convinced that God showed it's true, but many of us have also read Book of Mormon or large parts of it, and are convinced that God told us it's not true. So which one of us is correct? It's a pretty subjective test based on feelings. You come to the Quran, and the Quran gives a test, one test. If you want to know if the Quran is divinely inspired and from God, well, then just try to create a surah, a chapter like one in the Quran, and you'll find that you can't. In fact, it says you can get all the wisest people that you know and try to create one like it, and you'll fail at it and recognize that it's from God. Well, my thing would be, I think it's very easy. Just go to the last 10 or 12 surahs of the Quran, because they are extremely short. And I think you could find that it would be very easy to create a surah just like one in the Quran. In fact, you could create one better than one in the Quran. And now a Muslim may respond, yes, but the Quran is written in Arabic, and it's very poetic in the way it's structured. And what I hear from former Muslims who are now Christians, they acknowledge that the Quran in Arabic is very poetic. It has a nice rhythm to the way the Arabic is set up. But, you know, I can do that in English and make the English, or you could do it in German and make it sound very poetic as well and have a rhythm to it. So then it comes down to, well, maybe the Muslim would say, yeah, but Arabic is a more beautiful language than German or English. And well, then that comes down to a very subjective judgment. What if I don't think Arabic is a beautiful language? It's like choosing between restaurants, which food I like. Do I want to eat Italian or do I want to eat Chinese tonight? It just depends what your taste is. The test that Jesus gives is not subjective. It's go ahead and kill me and in 3 days I'll rise from the dead. So that is not a subjective test. It's one that can be examined. Now, when the disciples went out after his resurrection and preached, they said, hey, God has furnished evidence for who this Jesus is by raising him from the dead. And they said, we are eyewitnesses. So they presented evidence for this as themselves as eyewitnesses. Well, what good does that do us today unless we can examine that test to see if it's historically plausible, reasonable, probable that Jesus rose from the dead? So he gave us this test. It's more than a subjective test. And yeah, I think we can show that it's probable that Jesus rose from the dead using the tools of historians. Now, that doesn't mean that no faith is involved. Of course it is. None of us can get into a time machine, return to the past, and verify our conclusions. None of us can. So all worldviews require a step of faith. I just think that the Christian worldview probably requires less faith than other worldviews because we've got the evidence going for us.
Yes, thank you for that answer. If we approach the Gospels historically and we look at the Gospel accounts of the resurrection, we can see quite a lot of differences. For example, Christians like who found the tomb, but also when exactly did it happen and who saw Jesus at all. Why do you still consider these accounts historically reliable despite those differences?
Well, as you know, Han, I've spent years studying differences in the Gospels, about 11 years of focused study on that topic. The more I studied it, the more, you get used to certain things. You get used to the literature. It's not just the Gospels I was studying. It's also other ancient biographies written around the same time and the way history was written. We have to understand that back in antiquity, people didn't always just have their phones out and recording what's going on and then later on could view the video or transcribe it. Shorthand was in its infancy stages in the first century, and the best people who could write shorthand were probably in Rome. So there was memory. And yes, people could remember things a lot better than we can today because they didn't have all the other, we don't have to remember things today for the most part, but they did back then. So their memories would be a little better, but still you're not going to hear a person give an entire sermon or lecture and then be able to recall that word for word. So for example, did Jesus heal the blind man while going into Jericho or coming out of Jericho? One gospel says one thing, another gospel says while he was coming out of it. So I'd say we don't know. I know people have tried to reconcile this and harmonize it by saying, well, there were two Jerichos. There was the old one and there was the new one. And, you know, I don't know about all that. But with all the differences, I would probably tend to think that, look, they knew Jesus healed a blind man in the vicinity of Jericho during a visit to Jericho. And maybe years later, they didn't remember whether it happened inside or as they were going in or coming out of Jericho. And so rather than just saying, you know, they didn't have footnotes back then. So rather than saying, I don't realize that this was while he was going in or coming out, they just narrated one way or the other. I think we find this with Peter denying Jesus three times. That is mentioned in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And if you look at the location of where the person challenged Peter and said, hey, weren't you one of them? Weren't you with Jesus? The location, especially in the second and third time, or the second time, that differs between the Gospels. I think Mark says it was the same female servant for the second one. Matthew says it was a different one. Luke says it was a young man. And John says it was multiple people. You can try to harmonize those. But I think at the end of the day, oh, and one of the gospels says that the second one was Peter was at the gate, and the other says, no, he was by the fire. I think what was probably remembered here is that Peter was inside the courtyard of the high priest. Three times people asked him, challenged him, you are one of Jesus' disciples. And three times Peter denied. And the gospel authors didn't remember, you know, the precise details. So they just created the details, what seemed to be verisimilitude, what would seem reasonable in this context. And this is something that the compositional textbooks by people like Theon and Aphthonius and Quintilian, Theon and Quintilian in the first century would say, this is what you can do. You can elaborate and create details in the narrative so that it flows smoothly. So this is how ancient biography wrote. Does this make the accounts unreliable? I don't think so. It just depends what the standard of accuracy is. So I'll say one more thing. I have a watch, a Seiko watch, that my parents gave me for Christmas 45 years ago. My first Christmas while I was in college, 1979. And the watch keeps pretty good time. I still wear it on a regular basis today. It's about 20 seconds fast a day. But if someone said, well, is your watch reliable? I'd say, yes. You know, to get to a lunch appointment or to catch a flight. Yeah, it's always going to be reliable. It has never stopped on me unless I take it off my wrist for a while. It's utterly reliable. I can count on that watch to give me adequately accurate time to get to my appointments. But if Elon Musk hired me for SpaceX and said, I want you to press the launch button at a particular moment, not a second before or after, well, then that watch at 20 seconds fast a day is going to be utterly unreliable. Context determines the standard for reliability. So when it comes to ancient biography, even modern biography, modern biographers take liberties in the way they report things. Ancient biographers took a little more liberties than what modern biographers do. But when we are reading modern or ancient biography, we are still with the better of ancient biographers. We are getting an essentially faithful representation of what occurred. And if that is the objective of the good ancient biographer, well, I'd say the gospel authors meet that. So what time did the women go to the empty tomb? Some says, well, while it was still dark. Others say as the sun was rising. You know, it's in the vicinity of that. How many women went to the tomb? Well, John kind of suggests that there's one, Mary Magdalene, where the others say there are multiple women. But John doesn't say just Mary Magdalene. In fact, he only mentions Mary Magdalene. But when she runs back to Peter and the beloved disciples, she says, they have taken the Lord and we don't know where they've laid him, kind of suggesting that there were multiple women there. In Luke's gospel, you have the women come back and tell the disciples that they saw angels who said Jesus was risen. And so it says that Peter got up and ran to the tomb and found it as the women had said. Well, 12 verses later, you have Jesus walking with the Emmaus disciples, and they say, Jesus says to them, why the long faces? Why are you so downcast here? And they say, well, this Jesus, you know. Oh, and Luke says their eyes were kept from recognizing him. And they say, well, Jesus, we thought he was the Messiah, a great prophet, but he was crucified Friday. Some of our women folk went to the tomb this morning and said they saw angels that said he'd been raised from the dead. And then some of our own, plural, some of our own went to the tomb and found it as the women had said. So we wouldn't say, well, Luke, just 12 verses earlier, you said just Peter. He'd say, I didn't say just Peter. I only mentioned him because I'm shining a spotlight on him because he's the main disciple who went to the tomb. He's the leader of the church. But I don't say just Peter. Well, Luke, we don't do that today. Well, yes, you do that today in your everyday, ordinary conversations. But even if you did not, it doesn't matter, because I'm not writing trying to guess how you're going to talk to one another in the 21st century. I'm writing for those of us who are reading this in the first century. So the Bible was not written. We have to recognize in the 21st century, the Bible was not written to us, but it was written for us.
Mike, do you know there's an event outside the Bible where we have a similar situation where multiple authors write about the event and they have differences? Can we compare it?
Sure. Take, for example, the assassination of Julius Caesar. That is mentioned by Appian, Cicero, Dio, Livy, Nicolaus, Plutarch, Suetonius, and Velleius. And they each report with differences. In fact, Plutarch reports it in four of his lives: his life of Cicero, life of Caesar, life of Brutus, and life of Antony. His life of Cicero, he doesn't really describe it, he just mentions it. But in the three other biographies, he gives a lot of details in each of them. And you could say he even contradicts himself. And it's not because he's being sloppy. A lot of times he's just using various compositional devices that were part and parcel of writing ancient biography. So yeah, there's a lots of these. So if you're going to say the Gospels are historically unreliable because of the differences, you're going to have to say that with virtually every bit of ancient historical literature.
Okay, yeah, that's helpful. If we shift the focus to the disciples, couldn't it also be that these resurrection stories were simply created, maybe to keep the movement alive after the shock of the crucifixion? Can you rule out that possibility?
Well, I don't know that you can absolutely rule out all possibilities, but we're going to look at the probability here. Did they lie just to keep the movement going? Well, the early church reports that these disciples suffered terrible persecution for their gospel proclamation. And if you look at all the different reports, it says that all of them died as martyrs. Now, a lot of those reports are late, and some of them are too fantastic to even be believable. But I would say that we have five sources from the first century alone that talk about the disciples suffering horribly, and even some of them, like Peter, Paul, and James, the brother of Jesus, as Stephen, that they died and suffered as a result of their proclamation about Jesus. So the fact that they were all willing to suffer for this belief seems to suggest that they sincerely believed it was true, because liars make poor martyrs. Now, what's interesting, if you look at all the different messianic movements, there were lots of them in the first century, according to Josephus, and the Romans crushed every last one of them. And when they did, well, the disciples of this would-be Messiah just dispersed, and they either found another Messiah or they just went about their old lives, what they were doing before they found it. Even in the 18th century, there was another messianic figure named Sabbatai Sevi, and he was captured by Muslims and forced to deny that he was the Messiah, and threatened under threat of torture and execution to tell his disciples to become Muslims. And Sabbatai did this. He denied that he was the Messiah and told his followers to become Muslims, and just about all of them just left him and dispersed. So when the messianic figure was killed, they usually just went away. Their followers just went away, but not with Jesus. As far as we know, every last one of his disciples continued until their very deaths. Whether they or not they were martyred, they were all persecuted horribly for their gospel proclamation. And some, perhaps most or even all of them, died as martyrs for their gospel proclamation. Again, this suggests that what they believed, what they were proclaiming, is true.
One could argue at this point that we could explain that differently, that they believed that, maybe through psychological explanations, like individual hallucinations or group dynamics or personal visions. Paul describes something like that. What makes you skeptical about these explanations?
Well, so what we know about hallucinations. So for example, hallucinations are false sensory perceptions. You're perceiving something with your natural senses that isn't really there. So you see, hear, smell, taste something that's not there, or you have a sense of motion, in a sense, it's like dreams. So you dream you're falling, and you wake up. That is a kinesthetic hallucination or a tactile hallucination where you, the sense of touch. Maybe when you first got your mobile phone, you had the sense, you put it on vibrate, and maybe you were sitting in a lecture and you thought you heard it vibrate. And so you pulled it out and looked at it. And no, it was a false alarm. Nobody texted you. That is a tactile hallucination. So we all experience these kinds of things. But only 7%, or approximately 7% of those who are grieving the loss of a loved one experience a visual hallucination of that loved one. So that's one thing. And second, because hallucinations are private occurrences in the mind of an individual, they have no external reality. So again, it's kind of like dreams. And I wouldn't wake up my wife in the middle of the night and say, honey, I'm having a dream. I'm in Germany. Why don't you go back to sleep? Join me in my dream. Let's have a free vacation. I can't do that. She might dream she's in Germany. I might dream I'm in Germany, but we're not having the same dream. And we're not going to, it's not even going to be that similar. So another thing, let's just say, there's a group of couple of hundred of us, and we all voluntarily take a sleeping pill, and we are determined that when we go to sleep, we are going to dream that we are in Hawaii, okay? How many of us out of, say, 200 people are going to actually have a dream or in Hawaii, even though we all want to? Probably not most of us. And those that do have a dream that we're in Hawaii, it's not going to be the same dream. As the details aren't going to be so similar that we all think that we were in the same reality. So group hallucinations just do not occur. So that's one problem. A second problem, the 7%, well, our early reports inform us that 100% of the disciples believed that they experienced the risen Jesus. So that's a second problem. Third problem is Paul. Paul was not grieving over Jesus' death. He believed Jesus was a failed Messiah and a false prophet. So Jesus would have been the last person in the universe that Paul would have expected to see or wanted to see. He just wasn't grieving. So there are multiple problems with thinking that it's wishful thinking or a hallucination hypothesis. One final thing. Here in the United States, back in the 1990s, there was a very popular Jewish rabbi that's nicknamed the Reb, and he was up teaching in Brooklyn, New York, and he died. Well, some of his followers are convinced that he has been raised from the dead and that he appeared to them. But it's only a very small fraction of all the Reb's followers. And the majority of the Reb's followers think that these people are lunatics. They're just weird, weird people, and they're kind of ignored. But on the other hand, you got all of the disciples in the early Christian movement believed that Jesus had been raised from the dead. So there's a big difference. There's lots of reasons for rejecting the hallucination hypothesis or groupthink.
Well, I think it was Dale Ellison. He mentioned that Mary was seen by over 100 people, or they had a vision of Mary. Do you know something about that story that could count as
a group hallucination? There have been several stories about Mary and apparitions. What I would say to that is, I don't know what it was. I think in some of these cases, listen, I'm not an atheist. I'm not a metaphysical naturalist. So I believe that I have no bias against the supernatural. My worldview allows for the supernatural. So even though I'm not Catholic, and even though my theology would be such that I have no reason to think that Mary actually appeared to these people, I could still posit that, well, maybe it was Mary for some reason or another. I don't even have to become a Catholic to say that. I could just say, well, maybe God allowed Mary to appear to them at one point or another. Or I could just say, in some cases, the person, like in Egypt, Zaytung, Egypt, in the 1960s, thousands of people saw what they labeled as Mary on the outside of a Coptic church. They even have photographs of this. But it looks more like a ghost. And I could say, hey, this is a spirit being. It never communicated with people, never spoke, never communicated. So why should I think it was Mary? That was just the interpretation of some people, but there's no reason why I'm required to think it was Mary. One other thing I'd throw in there is a friend of mine, Ken Samples, went over to Medjugorje, Croatia, several years ago and actually spoke with one of the seers of one of the more pronounced apparitions of Mary. And the seer said that Mary still appears to them even to this day. It's always while they're in a trance, doesn't appear to anyone else while these trances are going on. And Ken said that this person even experienced the Marian apparition even while he was there in their presence, but he did not see Mary and no one else present saw Mary. And then he asked the seer, he said, has Mary ever communicated with you? And the seer said, yes. And Ken said, well, what did she tell you? Said, well, she told me to read a book. And he said, well, what was the book's name? And the seer told him the title of the book. And so he got a hold of the book. And it was a book on the occult, Satan worship. So it's like, okay, that would seem to suggest that at least in that particular instance, that was not Mary appearing to him. It was more demonic in nature. So there can be multiple explanations for these Marian apparitions. Maybe it was Mary. Maybe it was a spirit, a demon. Who knows what it is? I don't even have to accept that it was Mary to say that it was some kind of a supernatural event.
No, that makes sense. If we look into the context of the disciples, they lived in a time where they had a strong apocalyptic mindset and they expected God to act. Couldn't that collective hope have been the real driver behind the resurrection story?
Well, you're right. They did have an apocalyptic hope at that time, but I go back to all these messianic figures from the first century, right, that Josephus talks about, that they died because the Romans crushed the messianic figure and the disciples dispersed. And it's like, okay, well, this one's over. This didn't work. Let's find someone else. With Jesus, they didn't disperse. They continued. In fact, Josephus said they didn't abandon their discipleship. They continued, and the tribe of Christians remain even to this very day, Josephus says. So the Christians were different in that sense. You could posit, you know, Jesus did predict the end of the world, and some of his predictions seem to suggest it would happen within their lifetime. This generation will not pass away. Some of you standing here, you know, those can certainly easily be interpreted to mean that Jesus thought that he would return during their lifetime. So yeah, there could have been this apocalyptic hope and expectation. But if Jesus did not rise from the dead in reality, and you know, in the second coming where the world would be judged at that point, which was believed at that point, well, then there's no reason to think the disciples would have just continued to follow him to their deaths and to their brutal treatment. So, yeah, I don't see where, I mean, you could say, well, they were unique in that way, but I don't see any reason why the Christian movement started by Jesus wouldn't have just become anything more than a footnote in our current history books if Jesus had not been raised. And it wouldn't account for the appearance to Paul, right? because Paul was out persecuting the church. He had no apocalyptic hopes about Jesus returning from the dead at that point. So it wouldn't explain that. It wouldn't explain why James and Jesus' brothers, who appear to have been non-believers all the way up to his death, that all of a sudden, shortly after Jesus' death, they become followers, and James ends up becoming a leader in the Jerusalem church later on. It wouldn't explain why they became followers of Jesus when they didn't follow him during his lifetime.
Yes, thank you. One part of the minimal facts argument is the empty tomb. And so maybe let's move there. The empty tomb is often used as a key argument, but isn't it equally possible that it had more natural causes? For example, that there were grave robbers or a simple mistake. Maybe they mixed up the tombs or anything like that. Couldn't that be the case too?
Yeah, you can posit that. That would seem to be plausible that there would be grave robbers. But notice that it wasn't the empty tomb that convinced Jesus' disciples that he'd been raised. In fact, in Luke, it reports that after Peter went out to check out the empty tomb when the women came back, he just went back to his home. John reports pretty much the same thing. Luke reports that when the women returned saying the tomb was empty and they saw angels there saying Jesus had been raised, they thought they were telling frivolous tales. So it's like the empty tomb did not convince them. It was the appearances of Jesus that convinced them. So even if the tomb had been the result of grave robbery, that still doesn't explain the appearances to the disciples. But then when you look at the empty tomb plus the appearances, then it would seem that the best explanation for that is that Jesus was actually raised bodily from the dead.
I think some historians believe that it was added later, the story of the empty tomb. And when we look at Paul, he is our earliest written source, he doesn't even mention the empty tomb. Couldn't that suggest that it was added later?
I don't think so, Colin. Paul is pretty clear that Jesus was raised bodily, physically from the dead. Romans 8:11, the Spirit who raised Jesus from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies. So he raised Jesus' mortal body, so he will also give a life to our mortal bodies. And then in verse 23, when Christ returns, we will experience the redemption of our bodies. This is a physical thing. When you look at 1 Thessalonians, probably Paul's first letter, the earliest of all the letters we have in the New Testament, chapter 4, verses 13 through 17, Paul says, I don't want you to be grieved pertaining to those who have died in Christ. I don't want you to be grieved as those who have no hope, because Christ will bring with him those who have died in Christ. So what we have is here a person dies and their spirit leaves their body to go to be with Christ in heaven. And when Christ returns, he brings the spirits back with him, right? But then going on in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, when he says Christ will bring with him those who have died in Christ, it says, then the trumpet will sound and the dead in Christ will be raised first. Well, wait a minute. If he's bringing back the dead in Christ with him, then who are the dead in Christ who are being raised? Well, he's referring to their corpses being raised, at which time then their spirits are reunited with their bodies, which are then transformed into become immortal bodies. So it's a bodily resurrection. And if you look back at 1 Corinthians 15, verse 20 and 23, Christ is the first fruits of those who sleep. In other words, he's the first to be raised from the dead with the resurrection body. And then three verses later, the rest of us are going to be raised when he returns. So in other words, as Christ was raised, we're going to be raised. It's crystal clear we're going to be raised bodily from the dead. Therefore, it's crystal clear that Christ was raised bodily from the dead. So if you have a bodily resurrection, you have an empty grave. So I disagree with those scholars who say that the empty tomb is a separate later tradition. And I would also add that our earliest traditions come from outside the New Testament, come from Papias, who's writing in the first quarter of the second century and knew some of Jesus' apostles, had heard them personally, and then had also heard from those who knew the apostles. And Papias says that Mark wrote down what he remembered Peter had said. So in that case, you have in the Gospel of Mark, he's writing what he remembered Peter, the lead apostle, the eyewitness had said, had been preaching. So he's getting the empty tomb tradition from Peter. That's pretty good. That's pretty good eyewitness testimony. It doesn't get much earlier than that.
Mike, do you think that this is a more German theory, or is here more popular that the empty tomb story was added later? Or is it a typically international thing?
I think it's international. From my reading, you have Anglos and scholar. It's a skeptical thing. It's not a German thing. It's a skeptical thing.
Okay. So we talked a little bit about the disciples and about their culture. And now we want to zoom out a little bit and look at the wider cultural picture. We can find quite a lot of other ancient stories about dying and or rising gods like Osiris or Dionysus. Why do you think the story of Jesus should be seen as something fundamentally different than these stories?
Good question. So first of all, I'd point out that these dying and rising God figures were very popular to be cited as something that would have influenced the Christians about 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago. But then you had Roland de Vaux in 1933. He had a really good reputation for it. And then you had Gunther Wagner, 1968, Jonathan Smith, 1987, Mark Smith, 1998. They all rebutted this. And by the time you got to the end of the 20th century, next to no one in terms of scholars were holding it any longer. And so in 2001, a senior Swedish scholar named T.N.D. Mettinger wrote a monograph titled The Riddle of Resurrection. And in there, in the intro, he says that it's unanimous. It's a universal consensus among scholars today that there are no dying and rising gods that predate Jesus. But Mettinger said that he would take exception to that, and he thinks that there were at least three and maybe as many as five that predated Jesus. But at the end of the day, he said all of these concern explaining the agricultural cycles, how you have a dry season and then you have the rainy season in which the crops start to come up. And so every year you would celebrate the dying and rising of these gods that was symbolic of these agricultural cycles. Kind of like when I was a small child, I'd ask my mom, what's thunder? And she'd say, well, that's the angels bowling in heaven. You know, it's like you'd come up with these kind of stories for that. My wife, her mom told her something a little different. Well, that's the angels moving furniture in heaven. You know, so I think that's probably more like it, what it was for. But when it comes to Jesus, Mettinger says it has nothing to do. His resurrection had nothing to do with the agricultural cycles. Moreover, these myths of dying and rising figures that he cites, they all occurred in the unnamed, gray, distant past, whereas the story about Jesus' resurrection happened within the lifetime of these people claiming that he rose from the dead and had appeared to them. They had actual alleged eyewitnesses for these who were testifying that they had seen the risen Jesus. So that's one reason. A second reason, think about who these earliest Christians were. They were pious Jews, and they debated over matters such as, could Christians eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols? could Jewish Christians eat in the same room as Gentile Christians? Did Gentile male Christians need to be circumcised? And did Jewish Christians need to maintain the temple purification rites? Now, when you're going to debate over the minutiae of the Jewish law to this extent, do we really anticipate that these same Jewish leaders are going to engage in wholesale borrowing from pagan myths to form the foundation of their own? That seems grossly implausible. And then one final thing I'd say, and I've got many different answers to this, but I want to be, you know, brief on it. We have, at least here in the United States, there are a lot of romance novels that are popular. There are movies that involve a lot of romance in it that are fictitious. But that does not mean that a person cannot experience authentic romance. So why is it that there is a market for so much fictitious stories about romance? Well, it seems because it's an insatiable desire amongst humans. They want to experience it. They just can't get enough of it. Well, I think when you think about life in the world, even today, but especially in antiquity, life in many places of the world is very brutal. I have some friends, Christian friends in Pakistan, and they tell me that it is a very common thing for young Christian girls, ages 8 to 15 years old, to get kidnapped and just taken away and forced to marry a much older Muslim man and forced to convert to Islam. They told me about a girl that had recently, they told me about this around Christmas time, that 11 months earlier she had been kidnapped and they hadn't heard from her since. Well, she was discovered and rescued in February, and in December, just about a week or so after I spoke to them. But then 2 months later, the same kidnapper saw her out on the street and they kidnapped her again, and they're still looking for her. So this happens on a regular basis. It's like, all right, and I know what happens in Egypt and some other Muslim countries. So life can be very brutal in different parts of the world. Slavery, it's just horrible. And in the Roman Empire in the first century, life was brutal for most people who lived at that time. So they wanted to know that there was a God that was going to pay, who's going to get revenge and punish the evildoers and reward the righteous. They wanted to know that when a person died, that this life is not all there is, that they could continue. And so we could expect that there would be fictitious stories of people returning from the dead. Why? Because people had a desire to think that this life wasn't all that there is, that God was going to punish the evildoers. And so, again, we would expect these kinds of things. But having an actual account that's well evidenced, like Jesus returning from the dead, that does nothing. The fact that these fictitious accounts in antiquity does nothing to undermine a well-evidenced, authentic account of someone returning from the dead. So I think there's a number of reasons. I've given, I think, two or three of them here. But I think there are many reasons for rejecting these alleged dying and rising God stories, even if a few of them did predate Christianity.
Let's take a step back at the end. And we all do apologetics, and there are many apologists that think about this question of the resurrection of Jesus. And I think we can say that we are not neutral on this question, because this is so important for our own belief. Could that also be a danger for us falling into a confirmation bias, so that we're interpreting the data mainly in a way that fits what we already believe?
Yes, we can certainly fall into confirmation bias. And Christians, apologists, that is a danger, you know, for all of us. But we're not the only ones, because everyone, no matter what your worldview, can experience confirmation bias. An atheist can experience confirmation bias. A Muslim A Hindu, a Buddhist can experience confirmation bias. All of us are subjected to that. That's why I think it's important for all of us to watch our biases and to take a good look at the evidence. If I have doubts at times, and I do have doubts at times, it is for this very thing. Has my bias gotten in the way and kept me from discovering truth and cost me eternity? That's a very serious question that every single one of us should be asking ourselves and then be willing to look at the evidence as objectively as possible, recognizing that we all have our biases, and then knowing that ultimately, at the end of the day, each and every one of us on an individual basis are going to, if God does exist, we answer to an audience of one, God. And it's not going to be, well, so-and-so, our parents told us that Christianity is true, so they misled us. Nope. Each and every one of us is responsible for our own decisions. And so I think we should take this matter of evidence, where does the evidence point? We should take it very seriously. And I did that. And that's why I am so impressed by the historical evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. It is far better. It's the best explanation for the historical data. And by far the best evidence explanation. It is the most reasonable conclusion, I think, when we look at this.
Yes, thank you. At the end, we want to ask a more personal question, maybe. We talked a lot about these historical accounts about the resurrection of Jesus. And would you say that your belief in the resurrection is mainly based on these historical accounts and these arguments, or does your personal faith play just as big as a role in your belief?
That's a good question, too. You guys are asking good questions, fair questions. So I would say, look, I became a Christian at the age of 10, and my thinking processes had not really developed at that point. I heard the message. It made sense to me as a child, and I became a Christian. It was entirely by faith that I became a Christian at the age of 10. But it was when I was in my mid-20s that I was really beginning to doubt my faith at that point. And that's when I wanted evidence. So in answer to your question, I would say I did not become a Christian because of the evidence. I became a Christian by faith, because of faith. But I have remained a Christian because of the evidence. I looked at the evidence as objectively as possible, at least within my capacity, as objectively as I was able. My wife, two of my mentors, plus my doctor father, all of them knew how much I wrestled with my own personal biases to make sure that I was trying to neutralize them as much as possible so I could make a decision based on the facts alone. Did I do it perfectly? No, nobody can do it perfectly. But they know how much I really authentically wrestled with this. I would say I did not become a Christian because of the evidence, but I remain a Christian today because of the evidence, not because of faith, but because of the evidence.
Mike, thank you so much for your thoughts and your answers. I think it was really on point, and at least for me, very helpful what you said. It was, as we said, a great honor. Thank you for being here with us today.
Well, thank you for having me, and this has been a pleasure. Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah, we come back on that. And we are also very interested what you think of this episode. Let us hear your thoughts, your comments, through our usual channels, and we would be very glad to hear from you. So have a nice day. Bye-bye.